It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up later, we'll look at a new twist in the ongoing debate over a proposed casino in Kenosha. First, earlier this month, a 37-year-old professor of math from Stanford University became the first woman in history to be awarded math's highest honor, the Fields Medal. Maria Mirzakhani was born in Iran and didn't really get into math until late in high school. She was awarded the Fields Medal for, quote, outstanding contributions to the dynamics and geometry of Riemann surfaces and their moduli spaces. Well, whatever that means, it sounds worth celebrating, and women's advocates hope the win could encourage the next generation of women to pursue higher degrees, according to our guest today. Christiane Rousseau joins us now. She's a professor in the Department of Math and Statistics at the University of Montreal and the vice president of the International Mathematical Union. Christiane, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm happy to speak to you.
Well, the Fields Medal is considered the Nobel Prize of Math. Put it into perspective for us. How significant is it that a woman just won the Fields Medal?
It's certainly a historical day. Can you imagine? There was a first Nobel Prize in Physics for women, Marie Curie, in 1903. She also got the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1911. And it never occurred that that a woman would won one of the big mathematical prizes. So it's certainly a very significant day. And it's more than 100 years later than it had appeared in it had occurred in physics and in chemistry.
So 100 years later than in physics and chemistry, a woman getting the highest honor in the field. Why did it take so long?
Why did it take so long? I don't know if we can explain, but certainly what I can assure you is that it's not the last. We will have many more, because the women are doing contributions of the very high level. Maria Mirzakhani, her contributions are really first rate. She's the people that get the Fields Medal, usually it's because they put some bridge between domains of mathematics that are very far apart. And then you can bring some techniques from one domain into the other one, and ooh, that's a breakthrough. And this is what she has done in her work.
Well, Maria Mirzakhani is one of a handful of winners for this year's Fields Medal, but as we said, the only woman. What can you tell us about her? Who is she?
Well, she's she was born in Iran, and she loved math, so she went to Olympiads, and she won some gold medal in the Olympiads. And then she decided to study math, and she's a researcher at Stanford University.
And about her field of study, the reason she was awarded the Fields Medal. Now, it is not something that I can explain to you, but are you able to put it into layperson's terms for us?
I can try to explain. Well, in mathematics, we provide models for the other science. So, in fact, some models are some geometrical objects that could be like a model of some universe. And so she's studying some of these models. The image you can have is a surface. So you have a surface. And then you want to classify these objects. So you want to know when is a surface the same as another one. If you just deform it a little. So take a ball and take a donut. Suppose your ball is very flexible. Can you deform it in a donut? No, you can't, because there is this hole. So in fact, this is the kind of things mathematicians do. They will classify objects the same way you do in biology. You will classify species. But then Mariam, she went further on these different species. This classification, she puts some structure. The same way in biology, you will have the tree of life, so you put some relation between the different classes. So this is some idea of what she has done.
Ah, well, I think I do have a little bit of a better understanding now. Now, you have said, you were quoted in the Guardian newspaper saying that this is a celebration for women. How is the news going over in the world of math?
Oh, the news has spread. It's incredible. We have had much more coverage for the Fields Medal than we ever had in the past, because it's certainly, it's a model so for young women that we are able to do at the very high level. We can do the same as what men can do.
And is that something that you think still persists, this idea that women are not somehow as adept at math as men?
They like math. And a lot of women go into mathematics. If you go to an undergraduate classroom, you may have in many places not far from 50% women. The difference is that sometimes they hesitate to go to research. Research is something difficult. You are searching something. What are you searching for? There are long periods where you are just searching in the black. You don't know if you find. So it's sort of, you feel maybe less secure when you do research. And sometimes women, they stop before going to PhD and before moving to research.
Okay, so you're saying that women like math, especially at the undergraduate level. You'll find a lot of them, but somehow when it gets to the PhD level and the more theoretical places, women somehow...
We find less.
...drop out of the picture. So why is that? What's your explanation for that? Is it a confidence thing?
There is a confidence thing. I think what is important is that women realize that you could be a researcher and have a very normal life. You could have, well, in fact, Mariam Mirzakhani, she's having a family, a child, and she loves to do other things. And I think it's very important that the image is spread around, that you can have a nice life and do this research, and that you are a normal woman, even if you are doing research.
Now, she has talked about the problems that women in academia face, about how it's harder for women to stay in the field because they have to make choices between family and career. Now, this is something that women say across the board, whether or not they're in math, but is there something about being in the mathematics field that is less supportive to women?
There is some pressure. It's clear that it's more difficult to combine a family life with things. On the other hand, there are a lot of efforts in the university to try to accommodate the women. But if you look for the Fields Medal, it's not exactly like a Nobel Prize. The age limit for getting it is 40 years old. So the four people who got it this year, it's every 4 years that they are awarded. They needed to be less than 40 by January 1st of this year. This puts a pressure for women, because if you are to have your children, then maybe you don't have time to make your most spectacular contribution before the age of 40.
So maybe more time would be needed to win a medal like that.
Yeah, well, in fact, in mathematics there are no Nobel Prizes. As I tell you, the Fields Medal, it's the most prestigious, but it's not exactly the equivalent of a Nobel Prize, because the Nobel Prize is usually an award for career. And in fact, you could be awarded the Nobel Prize for some work that you have done 20 or 30 years before, and because it has had so much impact, then you get the Nobel Prize much later. This cannot happen with the Fields Medal.
Well, you're the vice president of the International Mathematical Union. Would you support moving that target age from 40 and under to an older age so that it would perhaps favor women a little bit more?
This is something we're exactly considering. We had the General Assembly of the International Mathematical Union recently, and we voted a resolution to have a committee that will study if we are to move the age limit. There are always, it's always delicate to move with a prize that has so much prestige and that exists for so many years. So you need to be careful. So we want to take the time before making any move.
Now, in any career, role models are important to drawing new people into the field, new talent. And it would seem that on the surface, that math didn't really have a female role model. And now we have Maria Mirzakhani, the first woman to win the Fields Medal, and also, as you say, have a normal life with a family. Will she be that role model for this next generation of female mathematicians?
I think, it's not She wants to live a normal life. She doesn't want to be just a star, and this is something we should respect. But it's important that people say it's the image is very important. You can be when you are a woman, you can target the same level of excellence than men, and the symbol is there, and it's extremely important. I have to say that at the International Congress, when it was announced, it was really a feast among the women. All women were so proud. There was really some excitement. And you know, the Fields Medal, it's kept secret till the opening of the Congress. So it's really, people come to the Congress, and there are thousands of people in the room. And in fact, the medal was given by the President of Korea, who is herself a woman. And the people don't know in advance who are the winners. So it's really some great moment. And we could feel during the whole Congress the excitement with this news.
Mm. Well, we're talking right now with Christiane Rousseau, a professor in the Department of Math and Statistics at the University of Montreal and vice president of the International Mathematical Union, talking about the recent win of the Fields Medal by the first woman ever, Maria Marzocchini. And she's 37 years old, and she is a role model, looks like, for women going into math. And we'd love to hear from you about this. What do you think can keep women away from math, especially at the PhD level, when you see women sort of dropping out? They seem to be more involved earlier, later on at the theoretical level, the research level, not as much. Does a veering away from math happen in elementary school? Is it part of the fabric of society that we need to acknowledge? What needs to change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, do you see a confidence gap between boys and girls when it comes to math? You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back now talking about women in math. Maria Marzocchini just became the first woman in history to win the Fields Medal. It's been called the Nobel Prize for Math. And we're taking a look now at why more women don't pursue math as a vocation and what's holding them back. And we want to know what you think. If you're a woman, did you grow up believing that women were just as good at math as men? Or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you're a parent, do you see a confidence gap between boys and girls when it comes to math? And how do you think that we start to address that gap? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We're joined by Christiane Rousseau, a professor in the Department of Math and Statistics at the University of Montreal and vice president of the International Mathematical Union. And Christiane, let's talk about how to encourage women to enter the field of math. Now, it could start at the university, or there are other entry points, you know, in grade school, but where do you think the breakdown happens when it comes to getting women, lots of them, encouraged and excited about math?
I think we should start to encourage them already in school. It's good that you have activities where they see women that come in the schools and give lectures or speak of careers. Also, when you have some extra activities and you try to enroll them in science fair, in mathematics competition. So it's good to enroll them before. At the university, it's certainly important at the undergraduate level to try to have, I could see, some special activities. Sometimes we try to organize in Canada some workshops for women in math. Usually it's more already students that are at the graduate level, but we should have more of these. For instance, the undergraduate math conference last year, so all the universities have this national conference. They had a special activity for women in math, and so they had invited some professors, and the girls were there, and then the professors with professors would talk of their life and how they like their career, how they like what they do.
Now, Maria Marzocchini had said something about math that I thought was striking. She said that it reveals its beauty, and I'm going to paraphrase here, when you dig deeper, and that until you get to the point where you really can see its beauty, it seems soulless and cold. Do educators, do you think, need to do a better job at helping students to see the beauty of math, especially women?
we certainly need, if we want to, we need to show the beauty of math. In fact, we love mathematics, and this is something we really need to show in the schools, because math is not a popular subject. But in fact, you see, as professor at the University of Montreal, I do a lot of my teaching with future high school teachers, because I find it's extremely important that teachers be very motivated. And when the kids in school say, but what is mathematics useful for, that they have some very interesting examples, and that they can show where we are going much further, so what they can do with math. Because if you are just told, okay, you have to study it, and you will know in some years what it's useful for and why you did it, this is not a good motivation.
Right, so showcase the way that math can have applications in life, it sounds like, is part of it. And also, do we need to change the way that we talk about math and culture? We often joke that it's nerdy, it's boring, and is that kind of talk turning people off from pursuing math as a career, men or women?
We say it's boring. I wouldn't put it differently. Mathematics is, of course, for me it's a beautiful subject, but it's difficult. But I could say we should change our system of how we consider the difficult things. Doing difficult things is fun. And it seems funny when I say that with math, but think of sports. If you are to say that a kid, he wants to be a champion, a very high-level hockey player, he's ready to work very hard to do it. It doesn't come by itself. You have to work. If you want to be very good at sports, you have to work to make efforts. If you want to be very good in music, then you have to practice, and you need a lot of discipline and to work very hard. People won't say it's boring. It's difficult, but it's fun doing difficult things, and this is how we should have math. Of course, it's a subject that is somewhat difficult, but we could try to bring it that it's fun to do difficult things.
Hmm. And when we look at math in popular culture, at least in America, you're Canadian, but I'm wondering, science is experiencing a boom right now. It's fueled by TV shows like Breaking Bad and The Big Bang Theory. Does math need something like that?
Yeah, but in fact, you may not have been aware, but last year we had an International Year of Mathematics of Planet Earth, and we did a lot of that. In fact, I was the person who started that International Year. So we did a lot of things with having, there were public lectures in many places around the world, so included in the States, and we tried all these lectures where videotape, we could have it. So, and we built a lot of material on the Internet. There was a Math Awareness Month, which is organized every year in the States with the theme of sustainability, because showing how mathematics is important when we want to move to sustainable development. So there we should do more, but that was when we decided to hold this international year. So mathematics and planet Earth. So you see, make the link between the planet and all the things that we need to, how we organize the planet. So you organize the transport, the energy, the resources. There are also the planetary challenge, how we will move if the climate is warming, all these things, and showing how math has an important role to play. It changes the image of math when you show how it's important in all these issues.
Now, what would you say to a girl or a young woman, a university student, about why to go for it in math and to pursue math as far as they could take it?
I would say, okay, for me, when I want to encourage a girl to go as far as she can, for instance, going further than, first you have to feel that you are able to do it. The other thing which is important, I wouldn't encourage any person to go very far, do you like it? It's very important that you should find what you like in life. and not all people will like to do math, and in fact it's good. We couldn't have just mathematicians. So it's very important that the young girl would find what she likes. But if she likes math, then we encourage her.
Well, Christiane, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
That was Christiane Rousseau, a professor in the Department of Math and Statistics at the University of Montreal and vice president of the International Mathematical Union, talking about the first woman to win the Fields Medal, math's highest honor. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress. We'll talk about the legislature's response to the possibility of American strikes against ISIS in Syria. First, it's been a little over 1 year now since the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs approved the Menominee Tribe's proposed casino in Kenosha. Since then, the proposal has been a political hot potato and a source of tension between the tribes. And in a new twist today, the Potawatomi Tribe, who has been the primary opponent of the casino, is refusing to pay their annual casino revenue payment to the state, which comes out to about $25 million, putting added pressure on Governor Walker as he mulls whether or not to approve this new project. Here with us now to talk about this latest twist is Carrie Spivak. He's a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel who's been covering the Kenosha casino story. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
How you doing? Good to be here.
So the Potawatomi have opted not to make their casino revenue payment to the state, which was due in June, and this is a significant piece of money for the state. What gives them the jurisdiction to make that choice?
If you would ask the state, probably they would say nothing. They have the agreement with the state through the compact agreements that they pay, I believe it's 6.5% of their net win, which translates to, it's not public, but we've gotten through sources of $25 to $30 million. And the state believes that they have to pay that money. The Potawatomi believe that their compact agreement gives them certain rights of getting refunds from the state if the state were to approve the Kenosha casino. So they feel that they have the right to withhold payment in anticipation of the state approving the Kenosha deal. But like I said, to the state, they have no right to do so.
Now, your words, in their anticipation of the approval of this casino, which means they're withholding money based on an eventuality which hasn't actually happened yet. So do you consider this a preemptive strike meant to not so subtly persuade Governor Walker not to approve the casino?
Exactly. I think you're right on target because, again, the Potawatomi would claim that if they do approve that casino in Kenosha and it has the large negative impact on Potawatomi that the Potawatomi believe it would, then they would be owed more than $100 million in refunds from the state. And, yeah, they're saying, you know, this is our preemptive strike, like you said, because we don't want you to approve it, and we want to make sure if you do approve it that we get our money back that we believe that we have coming to us. The state, of course, disagrees with that, with their interpretation of the compact.
Now, I imagine one of the things going through Governor Walker's head at this moment is, were this to go to trial, which way would it shake down? And do we have any indication about what the answer might be?
If you ask each side, you'd probably get a completely different answer. The matter is in arbitration right now, and both the state and the Potawatomi have to submit final proposals to the arbitration panel, and they will choose one or the other, the state's interpretation of the compact or the Potawatomi. But then it goes to D.C., where the Department of Interior says, yes, this is an agreement we'll approve or we'll disapprove. If they approve it, then that becomes the compact amendment. If they disapprove it, nobody knows what happens. So then we can go to round 15 or 16 or whatever we're in right now.
Now, it's a complex thing here. We're talking about these tribal compacts, and some of which, as I understand it, indicate that if the Potawatomi Casino were to suffer losses based on competition from the new, not yet existing Kenosha Casino, then they would be required to be reimbursed by the state. Is that how it works as you understand it?
Yeah, they would have to be required. They're required to be reimbursed by somebody, either the Menominee/Hard Rock or the state. I believe the Potawatomi want to be reimbursed if it's reimbursed by the Menominee, they want to have the states guarantee that that money will really be there. The Menominee and their casino would be managed by the Hard Rock, which is owned by the Seminoles down in Florida. They have said they would reimburse any tribal casino in Wisconsin that can verify they have losses as a result of a Kenosha casino. And they always emphasize the word verify, which throws another curveball into the mix of how do you prove it? You know, what would be the standard of proving here's our loss? And for how long would somebody have to make that payment back to the Potawatomi?
Now, we're talking millions of dollars already that haven't been paid to the state on the projected, we don't know, approval of this Kenosha casino. Is that already having an effect on the state's budget?
The governor said yes. He said, you know, right now they're short 20. Well, he's not saying the 25, but he's saying they're short the money from the Potawatomi, which, like I said, is at least $25 million. So, yes, he's saying there is an impact, and he's saying if he were to approve the Hard Rock Kenosha Casino, that that impact can be much greater, that the Potawatomi could seek in excess of $100 million of refunds of prior payments that they made to the state. So, yeah, everybody's gambling some pretty big wagers here.
How much pressure does this put on Governor Walker, this move by the Potawatomi not to pay these state fees right now?
I'd say probably significant, although the governor knows how to return the favor by making it public that they haven't paid. So he's putting pressure right back on them.
And how do you expect this to play out? Right now, as we said, the Kenosha Casino is in limbo. Governor Walker hasn't said. It's been about a year. There's been no answer from the governor. So what happens next? Who's got the next chess move?
My, how's it going to play out? I wish I knew that one. I'd make a bet somewhere on it. But yeah, I don't know. It's anybody's guess. Right now, this matter is going to arbitration. The state has reached an agreement with the Ho-Chunk on how they would be reimbursed if they lose business to Kenosha. Although the Ho-Chunk is still, even though they have the agreement, they're still opposed to the casino. So the matter is going to arbitration, and the governor has hired, I believe it's for $1.5 million, a Michigan law firm, which in turn hired some gaming consultants to try to get a real picture at just how profitable would a Menominee Hard Rock Kenosha Casino be? How much business would it actually take from the Potawatomi and from the Ho-Chunk? What it would cost the state? Also, how many jobs it would create? How many jobs it would cost? Kind of that overview, since everybody's been throwing charges and countercharge. He's hired these consultants to come in there and kind of be the referee and say, this is what we think would really happen with this new casino. This is what we think the cost would be. And Governor, here's your scorecard. Here's the pluses. Here's the minus. This is why they elected you. You make the choice because, as I'm sure you know, the governor has unilateral authority by federal law to either approve the casino or shoot it down.
And meanwhile, this is an election year. Governor Walker's seat is in the running. Is this going to affect the race at all, do you think?
It could. I mean, you probably saw the poll numbers that came out today from Marquette that it's a very, very tight race. One would have to assume that in Kenosha and Racine, they would be very much pro the casino because of the job issue. The rest of the state, you know, it's gambling's a hot topic. So, yes, it is a political issue. It could have an impact on a campaign, but I don't think anybody really knows exactly how much and how so. Some of the Democrats, especially down in that part of the state, are trying to make it more of an issue by calling on the governor to approve the casino immediately. Mary Burke hasn't really made it a big issue. So, you know, that one's still up in the air. You know, it will be an issue. How big of an issue? I'm really not sure. I don't think anybody is right now.
As we said, it's been a year, more or less, since the proposal was on the table for Governor Walker to consider. Now he's brought in some outside consultants. Is there any kind of moratorium on how long that he can sit on this decision before somebody turns into a pumpkin here?
February 19th. He was the feds approved the casino a year ago, August 23rd. They gave him 1 year to decide. he asked for and has received a six-month extension, which brings you out into February. So he has until mid-February to make a decision up or down. If he were to lose the election, it still would more than likely be his decision. I guess he could not do anything and leave it for Burke if he were to lose. But one would have to think that he'll make the decision one way or the other, whether he wins or loses in November.
And Kerry, as the weeks go by, what are you going to be watching for with this story?
Boy, that's a tough one. It was supposed to have been kind of quiet, and the quiet period abruptly ended yesterday. I expect to see more posturing. I expect to see the Democrats in the Kenosha area to continue trying to pressure the governor into making a decision, into approving it. I expect that the Potawatomi will continue to be opposing it. And the arbitration will be going on, although that will be confidential. So I don't know if I'm expecting or hoping for some leaks out of the arbitration process to see, you know, what recommendation will be sent to the U.S. Department of Interior.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. Kerry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
We've been talking with Kerry Spivak, a reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's time for our weekly look at Congress. Congress returns to Washington next week after its month-long August recess, and tension over the president's inclusion of Congress in policy decisions remains high. The Obama administration announced yesterday it will pursue an international climate change accord that wouldn't need to be ratified by Congress, and executive action on immigration is expected this week. The president has also not committed to whether or not he would ask Congress for permission to strike the Islamist group ISIS in Syria. On a different note, yesterday Burger King announced it will acquire Canadian chain Tim Hortons and move its headquarters north in what's known as a tax inversion. Legislators on both sides of the aisle have responded, condemning Burger King and U.S. corporate tax laws. Our weekly commentator on Congress, Paul Singer, is out this week, and Susan Davis, chief congressional reporter at USA Today, is here with us. Susan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So there were a lot of comments yesterday from both the president and legislature about Burger King's plan to acquire Tim Hortons in favor of lower corporate taxes. Can you give us the inside scoop here on how Congress is dealing with the reality of a trademark American brand heading north to Canada?
Well, this is an issue that has really percolated in the past month or so. We saw it earlier this summer when Chicago-based Walgreens for also considered a tax inversion and ultimately changed track. There's agreement in Congress that they don't like this process of American companies going overseas. We've seen about 47 companies over the past 10 years make this decision. What there is not agreement on is how you fix it. I think Democrats more want to take more decisive action in the short term to narrowly address this, what we call tax inversion that these companies are doing. But Republicans say you cannot change the corporate tax code bit by bit, and that the only way to really address this problem is to do a really comprehensive overhaul of the federal tax code, which has gotten very complicated. I don't think there's any disagreement on that. But the prospect of doing that now in September, you know, 8 to 10 weeks before an election is almost inconceivable.
Now, the president himself has had a few words about this, indicating that Burger King is not essentially being patriotic. Are comments like that going to make any difference here?
I don't know if they're going to make any difference from a policy standpoint, but I do think that this is something that, because we are in an election year, and I do think that in some ways I think Democrats see that this may help them make an argument for their side of the tax argument, that the tax code, that businesses are manipulating the tax code to protect their own profits, not to protect American workers, and that they've really tried to hammer this sort of middle-class message. I think in a lot of ways, Democrats have sought to try and spark a little bit of a populist anger in the electorate. I think they've had, you know, varying degrees of success on that, on issues like the minimum wage, equal pay for women, things that I think resonate on a worker level. I don't know if it's going to be effective, but I think that you hearing it from the president, we've heard it a lot from top Democrats in the Senate. Richard Durbin, who's the number two Democrat in the Senate, this has been a huge issue for him. And he's really tried to draw a lot of attention to it, because I think it's something that average Americans just have a pretty visceral reaction to, is these sort of iconic companies, I think Burger King probably falls into that, that are so closely aligned with American, you know, capitalism heading overseas. People just don't like it. They have a very visceral dislike of that practice.
And so you're talking about here what would be required would be a major overhaul of the tax code. And you've got Democrats on one side and way over on the other side Republicans, and their ideas don't have a lot of overlap. So how likely are we to see any corporate tax reform?
I think at the earliest you'd ever see real effort is next year in 2015. A couple of interesting things. Paul Ryan, who is currently the budget chairman, is very likely going to be the next head of the Ways and Means Committee in the House. And that is the committee that has jurisdiction over the tax code. He has made very clear that he wants to try and pass comprehensive tax reform. I think a lot of what happens and how likely that is what's going to happen in the Senate. If the Senate flips and is taken and Republicans take control, I think you could make a case that there might actually be an ability for a Republican-controlled Congress to reach a deal with Barack Obama on this. In some ways, there's already been common ground. For instance, the president has said in the context of tax reform that he could support a lower corporate tax rate, which is a pretty common accepted view among Republicans. So I think that it is not inconceivable that something could get done, but I think if Congress remains divided, it's much harder for a divided Congress to find agreement on what the tax code should look like than perhaps a unified Congress against a president of the opposing party.
And moving on to our next issue, looking at the president, he's taking quite a bit of action on his own on different fronts. And one of these is climate change. He's working on a new accord that would not require the approval of Congress. How would that work?
You know, I've seen this right now, and I'm very skeptical about how much teeth something like this could have. It does also raise some element of what I think Senate Republicans in particular would say are some constitutional questions about how far can the president go to agree to what appears to be a treaty without having two-thirds of the Senate ratifying it. What we do know is that there is not a two-thirds vote in the Senate right now to ratify any sort of global climate or pollution treaties that we would engage with in other countries. That's just not there. I think, and this is one of those situations where the devil's in the details, I do not know how far the president can go to committing the U.S. to reduce population without either an act of Congress or a treaty ratified by Congress. I think it raises a lot of the separation of powers issues that we've seen already this year in terms of the executive orders that he's issued and of the pushback he's seen there. House Speaker John Boehner is already moving forward with a lawsuit from the House's perspective against the administration on what they say is an overreach of power. But I think it is, from the Democrats standpoint, I think it's, and even from the White House standpoint, is he has very much faced an inactive Congress. This Congress that is going to end at the end of this year has been perhaps one of the most, if not the most, unproductive in the post-World War II era. So the president has said time and time again, if Congress is not going to act, I'm going to use every tool in my toolbox to move forward on the policies that I want to see advanced. Now, this is a really curious, and I'm not sure, it's certainly not in his presidency, there's a precedent for it. So I think one, announcing this, that he was going to do this, is part of the message that he sent, that where Congress is inactive, he will act. I just think there is still a lot of unanswered questions about how impactful and how meaningful any action he could take as a standalone measure on that issue.
Well, I think it's being billed as sort of an amendment to an old accord rather than something that's new. Is that approach, do you think, going to give it a little more leverage?
But I do think it sort of raises a lot of legal questions. I'm not sure what the president can unilaterally agree to if it comes to things like curbing carbon emissions or certain proposals of what they want to see in it. I seem certain that he'll probably move forward with that if they're saying that's what they're going to do. I can't imagine that he can do this without also provoking a lot of blowback on it and having legal issues raised. I'm sure that the White House believes that they're on solid footing doing this, but in some ways I think it's perhaps more about message and politics than it is about policy and really trying to solve the question of climate change.
Now, speaking of the president acting alone, another area where he appears to be doing this is immigration. He's got some new executive order on the table about legal immigration. What are we seeing there?
Well, the White House has been sort of dancing around this. They've acknowledged that the president, particularly, again, in the face of inaction from Congress, is going to look and is considering an executive order that would essentially slow the deportation of 6 to 7 million undocumented in the U.S. We have not seen any specifics on this proposal. The White House, the president himself has not acknowledged anything that he's going to do, but White House staff and senior aides have hinted that this is one of the things in the orbit of consideration. If the president does it, if the White House moves forward on that, it will be really fascinating to see the impact it has on the political debate in the closing weeks of the midterm elections. We're about 8 to 10 weeks out from the midterms, and I think that immigration, as of right now, has not really been a defining issue in most of the contested 2014 races. We've seen a little bit in Colorado, certainly in some races in California, but it has not been a real driver of this election as maybe I think a lot of people thought in the beginning of the election cycle. So to take that kind of unilateral action that I think from opponents would certainly would describe any action that went that far as something what they would call amnesty, although I think it would face a lot, I would also enjoy a lot of support from Democrats, and particularly in the Hispanic community, who have really been pushing the president to take stronger action to send a much stronger message. What I just don't know is what the reverb effect will be if he does take that dramatic of a step. That said, he could not go that far. It seems like this is still something the White House is looking at. They don't know how far they're going to go, but they have said that if they're going to make an announcement, it's probably going to be within the next couple of weeks.
All right. Susan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Susan Davis, Chief Congressional Reporter at USA Today.